Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Today, how oyster mushrooms boost TB patients' vitamin D levels and immune response, University of Hohenheim in Germany. We have a lot more on health and healing today. We're also going to be doing a commentary, if time permits, from Chris Hedges from It's an Opinion TD, a new site, How Democracies Die, also from John Whitehead, Come Home America, Stop Policing the World and Waging Endless Wars, both outstanding commentaries. We're also going to go to the video today. We're going to catch them on camera. You're told that vaccines are safe and effective. You're told by the leading scientists in the World Health Organization. Then, yesterday, we played a piece showing she absolutely contradicted herself. She said one thing and then said just the opposite in a private group. Now, someone took a video inside of the World Health Organization's World Summit of all the vaccine scientists. Now, they're the ones who, at the local level in their countries, go on the media and say, of course, vaccines are safe and effective. Then why are they not saying that in a room filled with only them? Why are they saying that there's dangers? Why are they saying they don't have the science on their side? Also, Richard Gell will be coming on today and reading verbatim quotes from the world's leading vaccinologist, the top person in the world. But now he's under oath. We found this in a deposition, and we want you to hear what he actually says about if vaccines are effective. Also today, we're going to talk about how Bruce Lipton is talking about immunologies and vaccines. It's only a four-minute clip, but it's interesting. It'll give you different perspectives. So we're just going to deconstruct today the myth and lies, all of the falsehoods that are told by scientists for hire. They've compromised their integrity. And we're going to tell you the truth. At least here you will get the truth. And I'll also be taking calls on our talkback line. But we start with the latest thing. And researchers from the University of Hohenheim in Germany found that sun-exposed oyster mushrooms can be used as a readily available alternative source for vitamin D for TB patients. Plus, they have strong immune enhancing. Now, I like oyster mushrooms. In fact, I just had some last night. And by the way, that's a great little business if anybody wants a home-based business or just do it as a hobby. You can grow at least 20 different types of mushrooms. They would cost you a lot of money in a store. And after you grow them, you simply wash them, press out the water, let them dry. Ideally, dry them overnight. Ideally, you can dry them in a food dehydrator at 115 degrees so they maintain all of their potency, and then you can saute them, and they're delicious. This is saute with sun-dried tomato, sun-dried pepper, garlic and onion, saute it with toasted sesame oil, and then stuff all that into a baked potato. That's good. Anyhow, here they're talking about just how it's really good for the immune system for people with tuberculosis. Now, next up, from Shanghai Tong University School of Medicine, what is called a polypeptomy, patients given berberine, B-E-R-B-E-R-I-N-E, berberian supplement, and they have fewer colorectal adenomas. Now, we know that problems in the intestine are epidemic. Why? Because people eat a lot of highly acidic food and drink acidic beverages, and they have a lot of sugar. They have low fiber, all of which coalesce to create polyps, create different infections, diverticulitis, colitis, spastic colon, irritable bowel syndrome. All of these are inflammatory conditions in the gastrointestinal tract. Some are contributed, like Crohn's disease, by emotional states, lots of stress and anxiety. Others, just simply because they're not having enough liquid, they're not having enough fiber, there's not a smooth transition of this material down the intestine. And when you look at what a person is evacuating, remember, what you're evacuating in the form of dead cells, bacteria, and undigested fibers is what you had eaten the day before, except for the dead cells, and that's what you have to focus on. What do you want going into your body? What do you want it to do when it's in your body? And the idea is you want something really healthy, healthy for your heart. You want functionality. You want a food to be functional. And that's what foods can be. In addition to being delicious, they want to function to help us live a longer life. So in this case, a simple herb, berberine, B-E-R-B-E-R-I-N-E, reduces the reoccurrence of the risk of colorectal adenomas and polypoid lesions. And that's good. This was a randomized double-blind study. And this was published in the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology. So write that down as berberine, B-E-R-B-E-R-I-N-E. And it was only 300 milligrams twice a day. So that's not a lot. From Aarhus University in Denmark comes a study about sugar. It says that sugar changes your brain chemistry. How about that? The idea of food addiction is very, very common. People know that they can be allergic or addicted to different foods, crave it. Some foods give them dopamine hits, very similar to cocaine and heroin. And then become addicted to that sugar. It gives them a hit. But researchers have delved into this topic and examined what happens in the brain when you drink sugary water, in this case an experiment. The conclusion is clear. Sugar influences brain reward circuitry in ways similar to those observed with addictive drugs. The results were published in Scientific Reports. So, think of the hypoglycemics who have a little bit of sugar, then they take something that's sugary to build their blood sugar back up. It's only temporary. It goes on this roller coaster up and down, and your moods follow. High mood, high dopamine hit when you're loaded with sugar, and then low mood and anger. In fact, it's so common. I was just speaking this morning with a person in Great Britain about a health project they want to do. They contact me, and it's a good project helping people in Great Britain and the United States. And we were talking about sugar in prisoners' diets. And I told them that Philip Hodes, myself, back in the 1970s, were invited into the prison system in New Jersey, and we completely, radically changed their diet, got them organic food. That was no easy task. I mean, you have no idea. Got them off all the sugar and meats. And we were working specifically with a group of persons with full-blown AIDS. And we were able to keep all of them alive and rebuild their immune system. Now, we couldn't take in vitamin C drips, but we got them vitamin C in there. Just getting them vitamin C took us months. All had to be approved. But it worked. And we helped a lot of patients. But most importantly, they found that when they went off sugar and dairy, their anger subsided. There were less fights, less arguments. Well, there was a Dr. Scholenthaler and a Dr. Scholenthaler was one. Walters was another. And Strauss was another. And in different prison systems, they were able to get sugar and dairy taken off the menu, and they found violence inside the prisons substantially subsided. Well, think what it would do if we got off sugar and dairy ourselves. That would also help. This is according to the study published in Scientific Reports. When you are taking sugar, you are really adversely affecting your brain. It doesn't take much to do it either. Unfortunately, Americans chase the rush. And it's when you realize how dangerous methamphetamine is and how dangerous cocaine is marijuana. Now, again, people can get confused. I absolutely support the legalization of all drugs for just the obvious reasons, just like I support your right to drink alcohol, and I do not support prohibition. And look what we got with prohibition. You know, people still found alcohol to buy, except they were supporting organized crime, and that led to La Cosa Nostra and organized crime. When you have a war on drugs, we end up more people using drugs. A war on poverty, more people are poor. War on terrorism, well, that didn't work out. What if we had a war on food? More food for people? In any case, marijuana can create a lot of problems with your biochemistry. But the active ingredient that can impact in a positive way your brain, the different oils, the cannabinoids, those should definitely be used for brain tumors, seizures, epilepsy, autism, lung cancer. There's over 20,000 studies in the peer-reviewed scientific literature on PubMed alone on this, and yet our government, for political reasons, ideological reasons, they refuse to say, take all the prisoners out of prisons, clean up their records, expunge their records, and don't put any more people in jail for doing drugs, even selling drugs. It's stupid. But it's not smart to smoke marijuana. I could tell you a lot of stories about people who were my close friends who ended up delusional psychotics because of their use of it. But people think, hey, you know, they're chasing the rush, or they're chasing the euphoria, or they're chasing the bliss. And just turn around after you've had that chase and take a look at what has gone in its path. Next up, consuming more fruits and vegetables reduces the risk of death from heart attack and stroke. This is a good study at a Tufts University. It was presented at the annual meeting of the American Society for Nutrition. It showed that inadequate consumption of fruits and vegetables could be responsible for a vast majority of cardiovascular disease-related deaths. In fact, this study estimates that about 1 in 7 cases of cardiovascular death is caused by not eating enough fruits, while 1 in 12 cardiovascular deaths is caused by not eating enough vegetables. So you could prevent death by eating enough fruits and vegetables. It's really good for your heart. All of these good things contribute to reducing your blood pressure, reducing your cholesterol, and helping your heart. So, and it's also good for your digestion. Also today, from University of Exeter, which is in the United Kingdom, reconnecting with nature is a key for sustainability. This was published in the Journal of Environmental International. And they analyzed 24,000 people in Great Britain, and they look at those who were exposed more to nature in their local area and those who were not. For example, if you went to parks or woodlands or the beach or the mountains, and the extent to which they valued the natural world. And what they found was quite simple. People who live in more built-up urban areas and suburban areas and spend less free time in nature are less likely to take actions that benefits the environment, like recycling and buying eco-friendly products and environmental volunteering. So if you want to have a more sustainable environment, spend more time in the environment. You become more intimate with it and you appreciate it more. By the way, there are dozens of studies showing that the more greening time you spend, the longer you're going to live, the healthier you're going to be, and the less stressed you are. Also, we live by delusions. The National Health Survey found that 82% of American adults between the ages of 65 and 75 said that they felt excellent and were very good, despite the fact that 60% of older adults have at least 2 and more major chronic health conditions, diseases. So how do you account for that? Think of that for a moment. I have to deal with this all the time. I dealt with a person who wanted to be in the anti-aging clinical study. And when we were interviewing, we asked, do you have any pre-existing medical? Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm great. Turns out the person had four diseases, two of which were terminal. And yet they actually believed. I don't believe they were lying to me. I just believe that they believed that they were healthier than what they were. How often do you ask someone, how are you doing? Oh, I'm okay. Are they really okay? Do they even know how good they are? When was the last time they had their C-reactive protein and homocysteine and fibrinogen levels checked? Those are silent killers. Those are inflammatory markers. When they're elevated, you're more likely to die. Almost never. When was the last time a person checked their blood pressure, blood sugar? Unless you're diabetic, the pre-diabetics rarely check anything. So you see, that's why it's so important twice a year to get a full examination, get all your blood work up done, and especially inflammatory markers, so you can see whether or not you're really doing okay, or you're like 82% of Americans who believe they're just fine. They're not. They're healthy. They're not. And this was published by the CDC. So make sure that you're healthy. When was the last time you had a really, you know, good checkup, where you had ovarian and breast cancer checkup and not with a mammogram? And finally, milk thistle decreases the severity of acute pancreatitis. Wakwang University in South Korea did the study. Most people don't use it because they don't know that it's great for detoxifying the liver. It's really terrific for that. Also mentioning the liver, the University of Rochester just published an article in the British Medical Journal, Case Reports, showing that treating kidney disease with plant-based nutrition, and that is important. So a plant-based approach to stage 3 kidney disease was very successful. This was published on PubMed. So we got to know that there's natural, non-toxic ways of dealing with all this. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We are 18 minutes into our program. We're going to come take a break, and we're going to come right back at you. And when we come back, we're going to go to a video audio clip that no one knew they were being recorded. This was at the World Health Organization, where the leading world scientists on vaccinology were all appearing. So you had one big auditorium filled to the brim with people who are experts on safety and efficacy of vaccine, who would advocate with absolute certainty that every vaccine is safe and effective, whether it's taken individually or whole collection, that we should be mandating these vaccines because we know everything there is about them. You take a vaccine, you're going to get antibodies. Those antibodies are going to prove that you are protected. Good. Glad to know that. Oh, but then you're telling all your colleagues that you can't prove any of this. We're going to come right back into that in a moment.
You'll never find, no matter where you search.
Without the good science, we can't have good communication. So although I'm talking about all these other contextual issues and communication issues, it absolutely needs the science as the backbone. You can't repurpose the same old science to make it sound better if you don't have the science that's relevant to the new problem. So we need much more investment in safety science.
I think we cannot overemphasize the fact that we really don't have very good safety monitoring systems in many countries, and this adds to the miscommunication and the misapprehensions, because we're not able to give clear-cut answers when people ask questions about the deaths that have occurred due to a particular vaccine, and this always gets blown up in the media. One should be able to give a very factual account of what exactly has happened and what the cause of debts are, but in most cases there's some obfuscation at that level, and therefore there's less and less trust then in the system.
Every time that there is an association, be it temporal or not temporal, the first accusation is it is the adjuvant. And yet, without adjuvants, we are not going to have the next generation of vaccines. And many of the vaccines that we do have, ranging from tetanus through to HPV, require adjuvants in order for them to work. So the challenge that we have in front of us is, how do we build confidence in this? And the confidence, first of all, comes from the regulatory agencies. I look to Marianne. When we add an adjuvant, it's because it is essential. We do not add adjuvants to vaccines because we want to do so. But when we add them, it adds to the complexity. And I give courses every year on how do you develop vaccines, how do you make vaccines. And the first lesson is, while you're making your vaccine, if you can avoid using an adjuvant, please do so. Lesson two is, if you're going to use an adjuvant, use one that has a history of safety. And lesson three is, if you're not going to do that, think very carefully.
It seems to me that adjuvants multiply the immunogenicity of the antigens that they are added to, and that is their intention. It seems to me they multiply the reactogenicity in many instances. And therefore, it seems to me that it is not unexpected if they multiply the incidence of adverse reactions that are associated with the antigen, but may not have been detected through lack of statistical power in the original studies.
You are correct. As we add adjuvants, especially some of the more recent adjuvants, such as the AS01, saponin-derived adjuvants, we do see increased local reactogenicity. The primary concern, though, usually is systemic adverse events rather than local adverse events. And we tend to get in the phase two and the phase three studies quite good data on the local reactogenicity. Those of us in this room that are beyond the age of 50 who have had the pleasure of having the recent shingles vaccine will know that this does have quite significant local reactogenicity. If you got the vaccine, you know that you got the vaccine. But this is not the major health concern. The major health concern which we are seeing are accusations of long-term effects. So to come back to this, I'm going to once again point to the regulators. It comes down to ensuring that we conduct the phase two and the phase three studies with adequate size and with with appropriate measurement.
So in our clinical trials, we are actually using relatively small sample sizes. And when we do that, we're at risk of tyranny of small numbers, which is you just need a single case of Wegener's granulomatosis, and your vaccine has to solve Waltz. How do you prove a null hypothesis? And it takes years and years to try to figure that out. So it's a real conundrum, right? Getting the right size, dealing with the tyranny of small numbers, making sure that you can really do it. And so I think one of the things that we really need to invest in are kind of better biomarkers, better mechanistic understanding of how these things work, so we can better understand adverse events as they come up.
One of the additional issues that complicates safety evaluation is if you look at and you struggle with the length of follow-up that should be adequate in a, let's say, pre-licensure or even post-marketing study, if that's even possible. And again, as you mentioned, pre-licensure clinical trials may not be powered enough. It's also the subject population that you administer the adjuvant to, because we've seen data presented to us where an adjuvant, a particular adjuvant added to a vaccine antigen, did really nothing when administered to a certain population, and it's usually the elderly, you know, compared to administering the same formulation to younger age strata. So these are things which need to be considered as well and further complicate safety and effectiveness evaluation of adjuvants combined with vaccine antigens.
I cast back my mind to our situation in Nigeria, where at 6 weeks, 10 weeks, 14 weeks, a child is being given different antigens from different companies, and these vaccines have different adjuvants, different preservatives, and so on. Something crosses my mind. Is there a possibility of these adjuvants, preservatives, cross-reacting amongst themselves? Have there ever been a study on the possibility of cross-reactions from the panel members that you can share the experience with us?
Now, the only way to tease that out is if you had a large population database like the Vaccine Safety Data Link, as well as some of the other national databases that are coming to being, where the actual vaccine exposure is tracked down to that level of specificity of who is the manufacturer, what is the lot number, et cetera, et cetera. And there's initiative to try to make the vaccine label information barcoded so that it includes that level of information so that in the future when we do these type of studies, we're able to tease that out. And in order to as each time you subdivide, then the sample size gets becoming more and more challenging. And that's what I said earlier today about that we're really only in the beginning of the era of large data sets where hopefully you could start to harmonize the databases for multiple studies. And there's actually an initiative underway. Helen there may want to comment on it to try to get more national vaccine safety database linked together so we could start to answer these type of questions that you just raised.
The other thing that's a trend and an issue is not just confidence in providers, but confidence of healthcare providers. We have a very wobbly health professional frontline that is starting to question vaccines and the safety of vaccines. When the frontline professionals are starting to question, or they don't feel like they have enough confidence about the safety to stand up to it, to the person asking them the questions. I mean, most medical school curriculums, even nursing curriculums, I mean, in medical school, you're lucky if you have a half day on vaccines, never mind keeping up to date with all this.
Okay, those are just some. Now, as you saw or heard, these are supposedly the best experts in the world. They were all uncertain. None of them had actual answers. And yet when they go on the public airwaves, they give absolute certainty that all vaccines are safe and effective. They're not. And they say one thing to the public and something else in private, and they were not aware that they were being recorded. So we had that rare opportunity to present to you, just like with the Afghanistan war that Washington Post just did a series on, everything everyone was saying in the pro-administrations of Bush Jr., and Obama and Trump were all lies. Pentagon, the Defense Department, the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, the White House, State Department, all lying to us nonstop. And yet we're supposed to believe them when they say something else. So if we find that there is just terrible science when it comes to vaccinology, why aren't people such as myself, Richard Gale, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, and the others who have spent thousands of hours and doing good scholarship, writing dozens and dozens and dozens of articles fully referenced on vaccines' lack of safety and efficacy, doing documentaries on it, why aren't we ever invited to give testimony before Congress? Or why aren't we invited to talk? Now, anytime I've been invited, I always appear. And if you want to see what I have to say about vaccines under oath, go up to YouTube and look at what I did before that committee. And because of that, it helped stop mandatory vaccines, especially the H1N1 vaccine, four of them they'd have to take for all nurses and physicians in New York State. Interesting, because I didn't see a single medical doctor from New York State, nor a single nurse from New York State who was there to give testimony. We were testifying on their behalf to protect their rights. Why weren't they there? Why don't you ever see a demonstration by doctors or nurses? You don't. They're the problem, not the solution, unfortunately. It's like I had to tell someone recently, the fact that I'm trying to save your life doesn't mean I like you. It's that simple. Let's go over and say hello to Richard Gales on standby. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Now, you have a very important piece of information. It's about the top person in the world. If this person was talking before the World Health Organization, they would be deferred to as the ultimate source of accurate information. Tell us what they actually said under oath at a deposition that you're going to be reading us a few segments of.
Just read it. I'm going to read a few posts. This is from Stanley Plotkin, who's regarded by many, especially in this country, as the father of world vaccinology. You've heard, many of you probably heard us mention the name Dr. Paul Offit, one of the frontline vaccine advocates. Plotkin is basically the guru for all of Paul Offit's background in vaccines. And there was an article that was posted by on a newsletter in Italy by a group called Corvella. This is an independent laboratory they contract out to corporations and universities, but Italian parents had hired the Corvella laboratory to conduct independent research into the ingredients in vaccines. It came up with very startling results concerning items they couldn't even identify in the Gardasil and different kinds of genetically engineered viruses that were in it. So in their newsletter, they posted a thing about Dr. Plotkin, based on an article he had written, is there a correlative protection of or measles vaccine? That was the name of the article. And there were some statements that were made which support what we just heard at the World Health Organization UN conference in Geneva that was just played, the clip. Some of the things that he's saying is that it's not possible, this is a quote from him, it's not possible to rely on the antibody titer. In other words, when you're given a vaccine, you're going to stimulate antibodies, and it's called a titer when you're looking at the actual amount of antibodies in the blood. So he's saying that that has so far been deemed appropriate for immunity. More precisely, the fully protective level of neutralizing antibodies is not known. And he goes on and he writes that it's not possible to say with certainty that the measles vaccine is one of the main vaccines being looked at in this article he wrote. It's not possible to say with certainty that the measles vaccine gives permanent lifetime immunity. Well, we've never... Even the vaccine industry and Merck makes the measles vaccine is never. That's why you have to get boosters. So they've never kind of doing double talk here, as the natural disease does. And this is contrary to what has so far been propagated with regard to vaccinations. We have no idea exactly how antibody protection works, what the role of antibodies or the role of cells themselves in providing protection at various levels against the disease. So in other words, what he's admitting here is that we have no mechanism in place to even determine if vaccines are effective or not. If we don't know the mechanisms, then there's no way of evaluating or determining whether a vaccine is actually succeeding or failing. That's what he's admitting to. We go on here. There's one other interesting one here, and this is his admission that there are new strains of infectious diseases, notably in measles and mumps, and we're seeing that in whooping cough or pertussis. And these are called genotypes, so it's a different strain. There's a little variation in the genetic DNA makeup of this particular infectious virus, and that they don't know why these new genotypes are appearing. The question that they refuse to raise and to ask themselves is it perhaps because of over-vaccination? We've asked this question about why of antibodies have failed. So why are we vaccinating billions of people around the world against new strains of genotypes that a vaccine doesn't protect against? So in other words, that's why we've been seeing, like with the whooping cough epidemics and the rise of whooping cough, this is a new strain. You can give all the vaccine you want into people, but it will not protect from these new genotypes of these illnesses. And then finally, he says the possibility, this is an admission, and finally he admits that the vaccines can spread a virus. And this has been something the industry and the CDC has denied all along, despite the evidence. We've reported on this before in the past and have written on it in our articles of different studies that are kind of tucked away in a peer-reviewed literature, but they never make the mainstream news. So you have to kind of search this stuff out to be able to bring it to the public. But he writes that the possibility that subclinical infection or a few symptoms with measles virus occurs between vaccinated people should be taken into account. So he's admitting that there could be what's called shedding of a vaccine virus to the population. Continues on that line, not aware of evidence on the excretion of viruses from vaccinated people with some but not all measles symptoms, which should attempt isolation of the virus from these patients. So the argument is always being given that when there is a epidemic or a serious event of vaccine related to vaccines or something that can't be explained by the scientific community, they always frame this as being an opportunity to discover new ways of making vaccines or a more effective vaccine. It's always the situation in which they're actually admitting in a very subtle way the ineffectiveness for vaccines, because we always have to be making new improved vaccines. So just within that argument itself is an admission of the ineffectiveness of vaccines. And so when we look at everything that's being said against people who are vaccine hesitant or non-vaccinators, we pretend that we have reliable data and certainties. But it's those who are playing with people's lives, you know, those who are in the authorities, the CDC, our health officials, the scientific community, the international communities, such as the World Health Organization, they're the ones that are passing off these vaccines as being safe and effective. And yet, what Plotkin is saying, and what we just heard from the clip, is that we're making these statements without any of the slightest scientific proof for what's being said to the public. That's pretty much the agreement.
And Richard and I are doing a series of new articles on vaccines, including going back to the beginning, 1986, and showing you that the vaccine identification law that prevents us from suing vaccine makers for bad vaccines, that's all political. We have all the evidence that was political, who got the money, we're naming names, legislators who sponsored this. The whole system is corrupt, and you just have to understand that. And we've published over 47 articles. Go to prn.fm, look under vaccine articles, watch the videos. And we're doing another documentary as we speak on the politics and profits of vaccines. We're not focusing upon the damage as we have in the past to the children and adults. We're not even focusing upon the lack of science. We're just the corruption of the whole field. Who's behind it, how they control it. That's coming at you. We're going to have Helen on in a moment to give us the next part of Who's on Wikipedia, Who's on Wikimedia, the foundation that actually controls Known's Wikipedia board, and giving the public our bio on them, since they seem not at all interested in correcting the massive amount of fraudulent material, lies, disinformation, character assassination, reputation trashing that they have done with everyone in the alternative and complementary fields. So that'll be in a moment. But I do want to mention that we have a great special for you today. I mean, this is a terrific special. And it came about because I was speaking with someone yesterday who said, I'm on a limited budget, but I want to get as many nutrients into my body for the conditions I have. And because when I could afford to get stuff, I felt a lot better. I did a lot better. Then the person was out of work. And so I said, okay, I was thinking about this. And I said, well, one of the things we have to understand is that it's all based upon the synergy and which of the nutrients you're getting and what potencies that can do you the most good. And so this is for this person, but it's for all of you as well. This is for all the supplements, right? Here's what's in this. Now, it's 10 tablets, and you open them up, they smell because there's sulfur in them, and that's really good. My suggestion is you take this by taking like 5 of them and put it into a blender when you're making your smoothie. So your smoothie is going to disguise the smell and taste of it. Doesn't smell good, doesn't taste good, but it's really good for you. And it's got everything. What do I mean by everything? Well, compare this to any other vitamin or mineral supplement in the world. This is the Rolls Royce. You're getting 15,000 units of beta carotene. There's your vitamin A. You're getting 1,200 milligrams in a single serving of vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, 500 units of vitamin E, B1, 75 milligrams, B2, 50 milligrams, B3, 150 milligrams, B6, 102 milligrams, folic acid, 800 micrograms, B12, biotin, pantothenic acid, iodine, magnesium, 800 milligrams, and zinc, and manganese, and chromium, and selenium, and molybdenum, and potassium. And then you get the superstars. You get the really super nutrients. Mushroom complex with shiitake and maitake mushrooms, pyrimethamine acid, milk thistle, bilberry, lycopene, grape seed, coenzyme Q10, quercetin, ginkgo biloba, broccoli, acerola cherry, hesperidin, glutathione, conjugated linoleic acid, ginger, DHA, you're getting alpha-lipoic acid, trimethylglycine, phosphatidylserine, soy acetylflavones, inositol, lutein, citrus bioflavonoids, MSM, L-taurine. And mind you, we're talking about big doses, 500 milligrams, you know, of taurine and N-acetylcysteine and L-lysine and ornithine alpha-ketoglucurate, choline bitartrate, acetyl-L-carnitine, bromelain. All this stuff is in this particular supplement. So what I want to do is we're going to give you the Supreme Health Formula plus a book that you don't have. It's not in print. Reboot Your Brain, Diet and Lifestyle Techniques to Improve Your Memory and Ward Off Disease. The value of this retail is $163. You're going to pay for both of these today, $72.50. That's way above 50% discount. That's terrific. So it's the Supreme Health Formula Special, all those nutrients. So those of you who are on a limited diet, limited budget, you can't afford to buy everything separately, now you're getting it all in one. So it's a huge savings. In fact, I believe it was Neil who did the analysis. I said, Neil, if everyone bought every one of these items separately in the same potency and a month's supply, how much would it cost him? I think it was over $500. So you're saving hundreds and hundreds of dollars. In fact, you're saving over $400, and you're getting this for just $72 for both of these today. So what do? You're going to make a phone call, and you're going to speak with either Diane or Sandy. Here's the number. So call it now. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This special is available for 48 hours, and we're down to about 300 bottles left, so take advantage of it. You're getting a huge discount. 877-627-5065, because then you're getting the full spectrum, and I suggest 5 tablets at a time thrown into a blender, because it does not taste good, it does not smell good, because of all of the, well, just all the great ingredients I have in there. I mean, when you're when you're taking something on alpha-lipoic acid, you're taking that lipoic acid, and it has a strong smell to it. And a lot of the other, like choline does as well. Phosphatidylcholine is good. Acetyl-L-carnitine has got that smell. But boy, is this stuff good for you. This is phenomenal for you. So once again, give a call, 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with Helen. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you to the program. I'm Gary Nall. By the way, please do not call my office if you're interested in being in the new follow-up anti-aging clinical study, because it's only Lou Ann Panessi who does all the screening of people, and she'll explain the criteria. I'll explain that you cannot have a life-threatening illness. That's separate. We can help people and with separate protocols, but I can't give someone who's got a life-threatening illness one protocol to save their lives, but then give them a separate protocol impacting their DNA and their aging. There's two completely different ones. Now, my hope is that someone will overcome disease and then do an anti-aging. That would be ideal. So you have to be in fairly good health. Now, we've worked with people in this last study who had diabetes and arthritis, but for me, that's easy to help them overcome these. High blood pressure, bring them down. And we've had help people with depression and anxiety. So the 60 days, meaning you must be on campus for 60 straight days. And you're going to get the protocols, and it'll be administered. I'll be there, but it'll be administered by outside medical doctors, MD, PhDs, and it's going to be broadcast in real time so scientists all over the world can see this as well. So that's that. And in any case, if you don't have Luann's number, we'll give it to you in a moment so you can call her direct. All right? And if you want to be a part of it, 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Hopefully it could change your life. And boy, did it change the lives of the people who were there. Wow. At least those who did the protocol. Not everyone did. But for those who came in order to see could they reverse their aging process, it worked. Let me just read you quickly, because I just got this in. And I just saw the results, and the scientists are just flabbergasted. They've never seen anything like it. There's never been a study that's done this before. Now we have to duplicate it. That's the gold standard. You can't just do a study. You have to be able to have someone else take your protocol and duplicate it and come up with the same results. So let's see what someone had to say here. I got two of these yesterday. This is from John. I was diagnosed with clinical depression by a psychiatrist in the late 1970s and was prescribed Valium along with other drugs. Over the next 30 years, I kept stopping and starting the meds because of the side effects. I kept trying different medications, Prozac, Paxil, Celexia, and Lexapro. I stopped taking the meds in 2008, but would still have some heavy bouts of depression. After attending Gary Nall's anti-aging study, my depression is no longer with me, gone. And if I ever feel down, I know I now have natural tools to deal with it. Good. That's one. And then we had another one here. This is from Ron. I feel I've developed a functional coping mechanism and am successfully and significantly improving with much less bouts of depression. brought on by the tragic death of my life partner and soulmate. The bouts of depression are almost non-existent, and when they do occur, I have the tools to deal with them. These results were accomplished through aerobic exercise, viewing Gary's series of DVDs on self-empowerment, and using the techniques of introspection and journaling. I used the time during the anti-aging study to redefine myself and develop more meaningful meaning in my life as an individual. Thanks, Gary, for doing the anti-aging study and having me as a participant. It is my belief the results will have far-reaching benefits for all of humanity. Those are just two people. I got those sent to me last night. So I want to thank those people. So this is the one opportunity for people 60 and over. We tried a subgroup. We tried 40, 50, and 60, and that didn't work. That was a subgroup, but we wanted to see would people who were younger and in healthier condition, would they, and it was just the lack of discipline, I guess, and a whole lot of excuses, so we're not going to do that again. In any case, for those of you who want to try changing your life, changing your age, reverse a lot of conditions that we assume are natural and normal, which they are not. Help bring our brain back, our heart back, our arteries back, our muscular system back, our skin back, hair and nails. Then this is your one opportunity. And it's limited. I cannot have more people in this one than I had in the last one. It has to be matched. We're matching, so it's perfectly matched. But it's the only ultimate anti-aging protocol of its kind ever. And it succeeded. Now we have duplicated. March 22nd is when it starts for 22 days. Excuse me, for 60 days. There and then 30 followed up. Call 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Now we're going to go over and say hello to Helen. And she has been giving us input on the people involved with Wikimedia Foundation, and the question is, why aren't they getting in there and cleaning up all the skeptics and cleaning up all the misinformation and cleaning up the contradictions and the hypocrisy of saying, well, you can't be biased and be an editor, and then you only have biased editors when it comes to complementing alternative health, many political and scientific issues. Helen Beniski is on the line now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Gary.
Who are we going to look at today?
We're going to look at Shani Evenstein-Sigalov. She's an Israeli educator who's really pushing hard to get Wikipedia into the academic sphere. She's a major in education technology. She's taught all these classes in Wikipedia, and she really wants it to get this sheen of academic respectability. So leading entire academic courses based on editing Wikimedia projects in the vain hope of giving Wikipedia some sheen of academic legitimacy, even though anything editable by anyone is necessarily unreliable. She claims to have launched the first 4-credit medical school course involving contributing to Wikipedia, with her students becoming responsible for a mind-boggling 10% of the medical content on Hebrew Wikipedia. And that's not saying anything about English Wikipedia or Arabic Wikipedia. They edit in all languages, and it's not really known how much is emanating from her classroom. She also launched the first academic course on Wikidata in 2018. Wikidata is a database that's even less reliable than Wikipedia itself because all of the entries, little factoids and whatnot, are unsourced. You can just put anything in there, and indeed libelous material has found its way in there and caused great scandal. Even less reliable than Wikipedia, it's known to be riddled with errors, to say nothing of libel. Is this why she's now getting her PhD in Wikidata as a learning platform? That's an ominous thought. She is also a former board member of Wikimedia Israel, which is currently run by Itzik Edri, a one-time PR man for former Mossad agent Tzipi Livni when she was chair of Israel's Hatnua Party. Now, the involvement here is Tzipi Livni, who is still an Israeli politician, used to be in the Mossad, and her PR guy is the chair of Wikimedia Israel. So there's like a very close connection with the Israeli chapter of Wikimedia and the Mossad. And it's what looks like the CIA. Once you're in the Mossad, you never really leave. You might resign, but you're still connected. and the idea that this chapter has been weaponized by the Israeli Secret Service should concern people. It's a pretty big conflict of interest, I think. Former Foundation Director Lila Tretikov traveled to Israel and gushed for local media about how the country's schools were, quote, teaching with Wikipedia, perhaps a necessary cover for the Israeli Defense Force Division devoted to social media manipulation, which includes Wikipedia, and the many non-official Israeli groups determined to, quote, make Wikipedia balanced and Zionist in nature, unquote, an actual quote from the director of one of these projects, Naftali Bennett. And if the name sounds familiar, it's because he went on to become Israel's education minister. Again, giant conflict of interest. They're literally interfacing with the government. Wikipedia is supposed to be independent editors, and nobody's getting paid, and nobody's getting government backing, and it just makes things unfair. It's supposed to be an equality-based platform. Not some people have government resources, some people don't. It's pretty unfair. Who would also receive the, quote, special translation tool she gifted the Israeli chapter. The Hebrew Wikipedia isn't terribly populated. It had about 30 edits a day in 2015. Most likely because most of the Israeli editors are working on the English or German or Arabic Wikipedias. Sigalov's students have written, quote, hundreds of articles in Hebrew and Arabic, though the press release announcing her addition to the board doesn't break down that number into how many in each language, or more tellingly, the subjects on which they made their mark. And Sigalov, as a, quote, EdTech, education technology innovation strategist with postgraduate degrees from Tel Aviv University, has likely met with Bennett himself. A meeting in which it would not have been surprising, in which it would have been surprising if they didn't swap stories about their Wikipedia exploits. The two appear to have attended the same conference in June 2016. So you've got a trustee on the Wikimedia Foundation, the Global Wikimedia Foundation, meeting with the Education Minister of Israel. So there's a very definite connection with the government of Israel and Wikimedia Foundation, which is supposed to be, you know, all free world knowledge, not working for a government of any particular country. Sigalov had never even heard of Wikipedia until a friend dragged her to 2011's Wikimania conference in Haifa, she told the foundation in an interview from 2019. She claimed she fell in love at that first conference, joined Wikimedia Israel on the spot, and almost immediately became project coordinator for GLAM Wiki, which stands for Galleries, Libraries, and Museums. She was chair of Wiki Project Medicine before her ascension to the International Board. You might remember Wiki Project Medicine from the trustee I talked about yesterday, James Heilman. Hence responsible for suppressing non-pharmaceutical methods of healing in the same manner as her fellow trustee, Hyman. Is it her nationality, her focus on, quote, gender and diversity gaps? As you recall, that's a major initiative of Wikimedia Foundation is to try to get that gender gap fixed so that they can present themselves with all of the sheen of a social justice warrior, the fad that is currently on in progressive organizations. Still a major cosmetic blot on Wikipedia's reputation. Or is it her determination to shoehorn Wikipedia into education that gave her such momentum through the ranks? Imagine if school children had no ordinary books to access and they all had to get their information from Wikipedia. Well, that's what these education technology people are working towards, the idea of putting something like Wikidata, which is just completely, like I said, unsourced. There's no idea where any of this information came from. It could have been put in there by anybody with any conflict of interest. And there's no way to tell. So that doesn't belong in the classroom. And she's a member of the Board of Trustees trying to put it in the classroom. So that's her story.
Okay. Excellent work. And again, the public, the media, Congress are unaware of all this. We've published over 50 articles, including 13 legal letters that have gone to the Wikimedia board. So all the people you're mentioning and doing these bios on are people who are fully aware that reputations are being destroyed. Out-and-out libel is the norm. They will refuse to use any honest and accurate and positive biographical information, but actively seek out negative material. And we are making the public aware of this one expose at a time, and we have, just so the Wikipedia people who are listening, and we know they listen because they talk about what I say on the show and what you say and what we write about. We have over 200 articles coming at you, 200 new ones, and they go very deep. We've been just being very light with you up to this point. It gets a little more intense, as you will see, starting in 2 weeks. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. That's our program for today. I want to thank you all for listening, and we look forward to sharing more and coming up. And by the way, we had a dispute on our video streaming, and that has been resolved, and we'll be back on Monday with that. Have a nice day, everyone. Thank you.